Hey there! Welcome to the new season of the Dishcast Special 2024 election season. We have many people coming up on the Dishcast. Eric Kaufman's coming on to talk about the origins of liberalism and wokeness. We've got Bill Wasik and Monica Murphy coming on to talk about the history of animal cruelty and the resistance to it. Michelle Goldberg's coming on for Harris. David Frum's coming on to defend Harris as well and to talk about Trump. And at some point, we're going to get a Trump supporter to come on also. But this week, I can't think of a better person to kick off our conversation about the campaign than James Carville. And he's basically needs no introduction. Political consultant his whole life. Former CNN contributor, author of a dozen books. Now he has a podcast available on Substack. It's called The Politics War Room with Al Hunt. Probably most famous for helping elect Bill Clinton. And one of the smartest and funniest men in American political commentary. Thanks so much for coming, James. Tell me about Carville, the town you grew up in. I mean, what was it like to be actually growing up in a town named after yourself?
Carville is about 17 miles south of Baton Rouge, of Tiger Stadium, if you will. It's right on the Mississippi River. It's, when I grew up, it was probably 80-85% black. And its claim to fame was it was the home of the largest hospital of treatment for Hansen's disease, what most people would know as leprosy. And the name of the town happened in June of 1909, and it was called Island, and the mail was confused, and my grandfather and great-grandmother had been the postmistress, postmaster, I don't know, whatever, and so the postal designation became Carville. And that's where I grew up, in the, you know, heart of rural South Louisiana, around the banks of the Mississippi River.
Yeah, in a majority black district with seven siblings?
I did, yes. There were eight of us and had seven siblings. We were eight children, a typical, you know, big kind of French South Louisiana family.
Catholics?
Very. Extremely.
When you say extremely, tell me, because this is something I understand. Tell me about your mother's Catholicism. What was that like? Because moms are always the big one.
Right. Well, our community, there wasn't much there. He didn't have. So it kind of revolved around the church. I was a pre-Latin to altar boy. Could probably rip off a decent Confidia today. Mm-hmm. Starting in the sixth grade, I went to Catholic schools. So I was very informed by Catholicism, if you will. And my mother was very devout, and she had very much of a, you know, Marian adoration, I guess you would say it.
Yeah. My mother and grandmother would talk about Our Lady as if she was going to come over for a cup of tea every day. It was just constantly in the conversation.
Right. And I don't know, she probably said the rosary.
Oh, yeah, all the time. Days. And my grandmother would say the rosary with a veil. Did they have veils back then, or was it not quite that way?
Not quite that way. I think women had to be covered in church. It was pretty, you know, I could say, particularly prior to Vatican II, it was pretty orthodox.
How racially integrated was it as a church?
It's because, so there was a few black Catholics, and it was kind of, they had to sit in the last two pews.
Oh, Jesus.
I mean, it was pretty. I mean, that was what, but there was really nothing in Carville to integrate.
All right? Because it's overwhelmingly.
When I was a young boy, they actually had a theater, and the whites had to sit in the balcony because there were so few of us. But I mean, there was no public facility other than the church. And the black families sat in the last two pews. Kind of stupid, but that was just what happened. It was just life then in South Louisiana in the 50s.
Yeah. And what actually were the things from that Catholic upbringing that you think stuck with you, if anything?
Well, you know, I had a pretty happy experience in the church for the most part. I still like to go to Mass. I just like the framework. I just like to think of things. And I've, like most people have just become pretty disgusted with everybody but Pope Francis, who I'm not disgusted with. You know. But I still find it useful. And based on my understanding of the faith and my understanding of the magisterium, it's the most un-Catholic human being in America is Donald Trump.
Yes.
I mean, he's just it's just staggering how really un-Catholic he is. It's almost like, gee, everything you're supposed to do, he does just the opposite.
The entire thing for me, I mean, I could not – he was anti – I mean, it could have been the anti-Catholic man. There was nothing – everything I had been taught he violated. And I could find – and I was also taught that I should find something redeemable in everyone. And I really have a hard time with Trump on that. I find it hard to think of him as redeemable.
I agree. And I mean, the reason that I think religion has been, and, you know, to some extent much less, but continues to be attractive to people is the idea of redemption. I mean, that's the whole, that's a kind of the whole ball of wax. And I don't think that he is ever considered redeeming himself. I don't think he's ever considered a Catholic framework for his life at all. So you and I, you know, similar Catholic upbringings, and this is an offense to the idea of Catholicism.
It is. It's as if you took the Beatitudes and inverted them. If you took the seven cardinal sins, and he would be probably all of them. So you grow up and you're going to – tell me about your high school. Was that also – obviously it was still overwhelmingly black. And I'm just fascinated because you come from the South, and yet you were a minority, essentially.
What I love, Andrew, is I see these left-wing people – and they talk about marginalized people. And I grew 95% of the people I grew up with were either poor blacks or had leprosy. You want to really tell me about marginalized people? I had more experience by the time I was 11 years old with marginalized people than most people were having a lifetime. And I just find some of this stuff, when I hear this, it's almost amusing to me.
Why? Because it's some kind of abstraction they talk about, and they've never actually seen or understood a marginalized person. Well, they've never seen there are different ways to be marginalized.
Somebody goes to the Dalton School and thinks they know something about marginalized people. I mean, you don't. I'm sorry. You go to, you know, Cathedral in Northwest Washington or Sidwell. Are you going to tell me about marginalized people? Really?
But also there's a sense that the marginalized people they talk about are completely cartoon characters, whereas among the strongest people I've ever met and the most resilient and the funniest come from these communities. They're not the eternal passive victims that some people who've never really encountered it will tell you about. I think of some of the old queens in the South, for example. Did they know how to party? Did they keep their dignity? They did.
Sure. I mean, look at the French Quarter. I mean, understand, I had a pretty, you know, I was young. I'd sneak off and go to the French Quarter all the time. They had every kind of sexual minority that you could think of in the French Quarter. But there's a phrase that people use that has become fashionable, and it's one of my least favorite phrases, and that is the phrase communities of color. That's so white to assume that everybody that is not white is the same. I mean, I think it's a massive insult when I hear that because, you know, in Carville, we had blacks, they had a lot of people in the Philippines, Asians, Latin America. They were all different. This idea, this NPR idea that you're white and it's one thing and you're not white, it's another thing, and it's idiotic. And no one used it. I always give the example of, yeah, I live in middle of New Orleans. Literally half, 60% of the people I run into on the street are black. So if there were three black guys sitting there, and I said, hey, fellas, how are things in a community of color today? They say, what's this jive-ass motherfucker talking about? Okay? I mean, so if you just think about the application of identity language to everyday life, It's really silly.
I'll tell you the same thing. All I read about in the paper is LGBTQIA+. Have I ever met a gay person who actually uses has used that phrase in conversation? And also, it's like the of color. It's like, you think I'm not a lesbian. I'm really not. And I could not be less like a lesbian. And trans people are completely different than gay people. And what the hell are you adding asexual people? I mean, the whole thing becomes this condescending effort to basically turn an entirely different, diverse, interesting group into the same bland, similar bunch of people who need help.
I asked Tim Miller, why can't I get a letter? You got a letter. Can't I get one? Shit.
Yeah, everyone has it. You're lucky you don't have a, you know, the good thing is to get a vowel because it sort of looks a bit like a place name in Croatia as it stands. And they keep adding to it. Now, and one question I ask on that is like, why does Biden, for example, Joe Biden, use that term, LGBTQI+. Like, he's obviously been told to say it, but he knows that's not the way normal human beings talk.
He wouldn't know what it stands for. They put it in there and said, sir, you got to say this. If you ask, what do you think the L, the B, the G, the Q, what is it all about, pal? It would be just like when the woke stuff was going. They couldn't explain to him what it is. He said, well, sir, to have these people, I don't understand that. Didn't that describe, but, sir, let me try. He wouldn't even fucking understand it. And he could use the term, but he wouldn't. And that's one of the things that's kind of like about it.
That he's old school. And he doesn't really get that. But he's allowed himself to be manipulated by these others, though.
Yeah, and this is the big thing. And they all have staff and you know, some of them, you see, I disagree with the principal on this issue. Well, get the fuck out of there if you disagree. Why are you sitting there if you disagree on Gaza or you want that to resign? Who cares what some little snot-nosed 24-year-old thinks? I really don't.
It's amazing to me that the 24 snot-nosed actually has begun to call the shots in some of these offices, some of these organizations, which have become sort of paralyzed by 20-somethings who are basically, you do anything and it's racist, sexist, whatever you've done wrong that day. And then there's a sort of emotional blackmail to get them to do what they want. And it's not helping. They're busy fighting each other.
No, it's not. And their language is off-putting. And, you know, if you're somebody like me, all I really give a shit about is winning elections. Okay? Then you can go have all of the stuff you want after you win. But if you don't win, you got nothing. And I think the most encouraging thing is everybody has given Harris strategic space to operate in. And I mean, this coalition goes all the way from Liz Cheney to Pramila Jayapal and everything in the middle. And let me tell you, there's a lot in the middle. But I think that's a really encouraging aspect of this. That everybody, okay, go ahead, say what you got to say. We're all cool with it.
Yeah, I thought to that speech, the acceptance speech, I think what was different for me, it seemed like she was saying, this is who I am. Right. She wasn't appealing to every single group. She didn't mention race, gender, sexual, all that stuff was gone. It was more, this is what I want to do, even though it was pretty vague at times, obviously. But I saw her differently that night. I really did for the first time. And the other thing I saw was the power of a female politician being tough, really being tough. To use the word lethal, to talk about using force. There is some. I grew up under Maggie Thatcher, so I can see how that can work if she can lean into it.
So you took the word right out of my mouth because I think lethal was the big word. All right, that, and I also think when Hillary said we got him on the run, I like that. I like that kind of locker room language. You don't have to be a male to use it. That's what people don't understand. But I criticize.
It's even more effective when you're a female.
Absolutely. And when I criticize the party messaging for being too feminine, I meant the language that comes out of us. And you know, if you look at Walt, he has he's probably more liberal than I am, which is kind of hard to do. It's not impossible, but I think he's that. But he doesn't come across. He comes. It's so much more cultural than I used to think. In a lot of our problems, not issues, it's cultural. It's the whole NPR idea drug Democrats down for a long time. That hurt us. That hurt the image of the party and the image of the politicians in it.
Yeah, so, and now think about Harris, though. I was thinking, how would I describe Harris in many ways? Now, obviously, I'm not going down the Trump line. Is she black? I just think of her like I thought of Obama, really, as essentially the offspring of immigrants, a classic second-generation immigrant, both from biracial parents, making their way and loving this country because they had a chance in it. And that's how I would go about describing her.
Yeah, I think one of the things that we saw, we still don't really know her.
I know.
Convention taught us a lot, but education about her, I think, is ongoing. It's okay. You know, you kind of burst on the scene, you know, pretty quickly here. And she's going to have a chance to fill out a little bit more about who she is.
But you say that, but she has been vice president for 3.5 years. It's not like she's been invisible. And here's what really here's a question I have in my head. I used to read all the articles about her. Every article, even in the New York Times and the Washington Post, all the nice ones, they all said one thing: she can't manage for shit. That she had a 92% turnover in staff. That she has real difficulty managing an organization. Now, everything I've seen since she emerged does not suggest that, unless someone else is doing it. So, I wonder what your take is. That has she really changed, or is?
I think she actually has. All right, and her biggest problem, we know it, they know it, everybody knows, is at 2019 when she was running for president.
Yes.
All right, she is going to have to deal with that.
Right.
And she's going to have to deal with it in an umbrella way. There's no way she's going to say, I took this group, this thing, that thing, and you just all match up. Look, and the answer is going to be somewhat, I grew. And there are things I think today, and if I'm president for 4 years, I'll come back and tell you that I learned something and I grew here. It's got to be about growth, about seeing something, because when she came into office, people said, what do you think? And some people would call me and, what do you think her mission should be? And I said, she jumped right on top of this crime thing. And they said, well, we just can't do that. I said, okay. And of course, the crime rate's down like 30%. And she, of course, that's what she talked about in her announcement speech. And let me be clear, Andrew, anyone that has ever listened to the identity left on anything has lived to regret it. They're literally the Western left, the Western far left, has literally been wrong about everything from its inception. From, I don't know, wrote.
I was also just thinking, free associating here, Keir Starmer, the new Prime Minister of Great Britain. He also obviously was inheriting from Corbyn. He had a real challenge in reassuring Middle England that he wasn't crazy.
Right.
And he did. He did by being... By using the word he uses is stability, stability, stability. We are not going to be crazy like those Tories that gave you 5 prime ministers in 10 years. We're going to be solid and we're on your side. That feels like a kind of winning message here as well.
Yeah. Remember, you're old enough to remember the word Michael Foot, the longest suicide note in history.
The 1983 manifesto, yes.
Yeah. I mean, again, the German communists would march through Berlin in like 1937 and say, the worse the better, after Hitler, us. Yeah,
right.
After Hitler, I don't remember, piano wire.
Yeah, there is something, especially on something like if you are, for example, horrified by Gaza. And look, they're absolutely legitimate arguments on both sides, actually. And I don't think you can be a human being and not watch that without being just horrified and traumatized by what's happening, especially to the children, because it is overwhelming. However, Do you really think that Donald Trump is going to be better than Kamala Harris on Gaza? He has given the Israelis, he gave the Israelis everything and more and never asked anything in return.
So they were interviewing some protesters, all right? And they said, well, actually, Trump is, in terms of the issue that you care about, the Democrats are actually better for you than Trump would be. Why are you protesting a Democrat? And they said, well, we wouldn't have any effect on Trump. So you're going to take the person that's more open to the things that you want and demonstrate against him because you can't affect it. He said, I had a guy who was raising money, and he said, look, James, I'm Jewish. I'm very pro-Israel. I can't give money to Biden or to Democrats because of the demonstrations. I said, wait a minute. They're demonstrating against the Democrats. That's what they're demonstrating. So you say you can't give money because they're demonstrating against the Democrat. You just want a fucking tax cut. You don't give a shit one way or another about Israel. you would hear that all the time.
Or again, as you were saying, it's also cultural. They just associate those students with Democrats and therefore lump them all in together. And tell me the first one of you had one real breakthrough candidate early, Harris Wofford. I mean, you've always been a political consultant. That's what's so interesting about it. You've always loved the machinery of getting people elected or failing to or whatever. And Wofford, you did something really quite prescient, which is you went full out populist on healthcare.
Right.
Which I know has been your concern with healthcare goes back a very long way, including your own life. Tell me about Wofford and then the person who succeeded him, Clinton. I knew both of them and very different characters.
So let's wind back, I think it's like May of 1991. And John mm-hmm. Heinz was incumbent, since from Pennsylvania. He was kind of moderate Republican, Heinz Foods, which you think is about right. And he was killed in a helicopter crash in suburban Philadelphia somewhere. So Bob Casey, who was my client, was the governor. So they said, you know, we got to have an appointment. We actually all went to Detroit to try to talk Lee Iacocca in being appointed to the Senate and come back to Pennsylvania. Because if you remember, Iacocca was originally, I think, from Allentown, Lehigh Valley. And he couldn't have been nicer or more charming, but just said, you know, at the end of the day, I'm comfortable here. I just don't want to get into politics. Okay, so we go back. And Harris had been the Secretary of Labor under Governor Casey. And he was president of Bryn Mawr. He was a kind of patrician, polite, I think he was well-educated. I think he went to like Yale or something like that. And he was one of the few whites that was invited by Martin Luther King to march on the front line in the Selma March. But he was he wasn't a political insider. He kind of viewed it as a kind of noble undertaking, a little bit of a, can I say it right, noblesse oblige or something like that. You know, that And we knew that healthcare was the issue. I mean, we could poll and we figured out that that's where it was. And we kept pushing. And one day, he called in from the road. And Paul McGall and I were working on a campaign together. And you always had to remind him to make his fundraising phone calls. You know, Harris, you got 10 on the call sheet. You know, and of course, the aide would report back to us that he's not making his goddamn calls. And said, what's going on? He said, well, I saw this optometrist in Reading. And he said to me, he said, Harris, let me ask you something. If a criminal has a right to a lawyer, why doesn't a working person have the right to see a doctor? And I just went, oh, bingo. So the next ad, and it was one of those remarkable things where we started out 40 points down. And we ended up winning in an upset landslide. I think we won a goddamn thing, about 10 points maybe.
I think you were down 44 points at the worst.
Yeah, it was just one of these kind of elections where everything went right.
But you go from this aloof, genteel, sort of almost waspy idealist who didn't want to get his hands dirty, really, to this young governor in Arkansas. When did you first meet Bill Clinton?
So after Wofford wins, mm-hmm. Paul and I become a hot item. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, because because everybody thought it was, remember, the Gulf War, and we were doomed. All of a sudden, we weren't doomed. And so I met with all the different candidates. Then when you met with Clinton, you went, holy shit, is this guy real? Yeah, he's real. I mean, it was just so evident.
Me too. I had exactly this. I was
on a different skill level.
Yeah, I had exactly the same thing. I was inveigled to go. I was editing the New Republic. So obviously I was interested in these different candidates. There was a whole bunch of them, if you remember. There were like 7 or 8, I think, at that point. Right. And they said, he's doing a fundraiser. He's going to talk in this room. Just show up. I didn't know. And I walked in there. I was like, fuck me. This guy's it. That is, especially in the era of HW, he was so tongue-tied, so incapable of really, this guy was, first of all, so in control of the issues. God damn it. He knew everything. And secondly, he just seduced you from the get-go. There was no resisting it. I ended up saying, I'm not going to meet this guy ever again because it's too seductive. I'll never be able to run a magazine that takes him on as I need to if I'm, because he works his charm.
Right. In the end, you know, people say, man, that guy is so smart. I would say, you have no idea. So one of my favorite anecdotes, I've done a lot of work in Argentina. In fact, I was doing some work for, was then the finance minister, a man by the name of Domingo Quaballo. And I was in what they call Puerto Madero in Buenos Aires, is port. And we were in the Sheraton Hotel, and we were having a drink or coffee. And the guy came by, he said, Senor Rodriguez, come over here. This is James Carville. He's the guy that elected Bill Clinton. Not exactly true, but okay, it's just flattery. And so Senor Rodriguez said, but they all speak English. All right, all the governing class and commercial class in Latin America speak English. And he said, I'll tell you something about your boss. But I don't know, 5 years ago, he came to Buenos Aires, and they always stay at the Sheraton because we're the biggest hotel and Secret Service. And so he came in. And of course, I was out front, and I greeted him and welcomed him to Sheraton Puerto Madero. And he said, 2-3 years later, I get a call from the Sheraton people in Santiago, and there's an OAS meeting, and they want me to go over there and give a hand with the dignitaries. So President Clinton shows up in Santiago 3 years later, and I'm out front to greet him, and he looks at me. He says, I thought you were in Buenos Aires. Did they transfer you to Santiago? I know the fucking guy in the hotel from 3 years ago. And I just like, it's true. It's true.
That is also just an incredible political intelligence. Like the ability to remember people, to make them feel they matter, is a sort of very basic human skill that some people have. Like it didn't seem to me that his wife ever really had that skill.
You know, yeah.
She had to learn it in a way that was natural to him.
No one does. Okay. It's not, like, well, you're not as good as Shakespeare. Okay. I don't have to be. I can still be pretty good and not be fucking Shakespeare. I mean, I don't know how it's, yes. And I think to some extent, she probably suffered a little bit in comparison.
Right.
Although I did think that her speech at the convention was really one of the better ones. You know, it was kind of thought out. And she said, look, I'm over 2016 and you should be too. And that she gave us permission to move on.
She was also kind of feistier.
She was, and she looked great, I thought. I'm not supposed to say that, but she did.
Well, I just remember her in 2016, that acceptance speech, and I just had dread in my stomach. She was wearing that big round white dress, looked like an egg that she was kind of hatching out of. and it was just painful. Did you?
I was glad that Harris wore blue and not white. I'm a big believer that colors mean something.
Really?
It became a big thing in feminist circles because the original feminists wore white.
Right, right.
Which is
the suffragettes. Yeah.
I don't, that's fine. I mean, people have different colors. But I thought that her wearing blue, it's a kind of I don't know, is it the color of power or something like that? But it's I like blue.
I felt that visually, and I have lots of questions about her policies and so on and so forth, and I had a lot of questions about her ability to perform publicly until that night. But the word that also came to mind for me that night was authority. She really seemed to wield authority in a way that really shocked me. I didn't expect her. There was an insecurity about her that night, which surprised me.
Yes. It one thing I can say that I've had people that worked in the White House. And to a person, it's say, you got to understand something. She's gotten a lot better. She's a lot better. She staff work is much better. She's much more confident. And it wasn't just staffers. It was the kind of people that, you know, economists, historians, you know the kind of people that go in and out of a White House. It's a little bit of the same suspects. But it all come and say, you know, she was really prepared and she had good questions and she listened to what we had to say. And I am pleasantly but not totally surprised that she's a lot better than we thought going in.
Was there a point when you really got incredibly exasperated with Bill Clinton? Was there a moment at which you decided this is just nuts? I've had enough.
No. I mean, it was all, and you'd have to just grow up in South Louisiana and Baton Rouge, and it was all about sex. And honestly, to me, that's just pussy business. Who cares? Okay. It was my kind of like, and people would get all fainting in the street. And what do we tell the children? I'll tell them what you want to. What did Frank Rich famously say? You don't have to tell them anything. The second husband will tell them. it never even remotely. It might be just the culture I grew up in, but in Washington, I think you'll agree with this, to some extent, is a very kind of prudish place almost.
Yeah. There is another Washington that I've definitely been a part of that is not that prudish.
But I understand.
Absolutely.
The party crowd is... In New Orleans, or Baton Rouge, who gives a shit?
It's also a Catholic and a Protestant thing. I remember when my mother was talking about this to me once, it came up in some way, and she said, well, you know, it's a sin, but it's not the worst sin. And in some ways, it's the most forgivable sin because I think it was Malcolm Muggeridge that said that he had no problem. He thought that lust was completely defensible because it was so always give, give, give. He thought it was an inherently generous vice. But there were questions in a couple of cases, maybe because of the number of women he slept with. This is kind of, we should be noticed a small number. But there were a few that said he abused them in some way.
I could go and give you a chapter, verse, and who was this and that. But when I grew up, it's one thing, and a little bit different being French Catholic. I think the Irish Catholics are way more judgmental than the French or the Italians.
Yes, they're the worst. They're the worst.
Yeah, and I'm from Ireland. I go to family reunion usually every Labor Day in Ireland. But the church there has completely destroyed itself. It doesn't even exist anymore.
In Ireland?
Yeah.
I know. It's staggering. It's amazing. Yeah. It's astonishing. Would you ever believe that? Same
it's
in Spain.
It happened overnight. I mean, on history's clock, it all happened in 15 years. But boy, did it happen! And
the two countries that have veered furthest away are the ones whose churches were the most political: Spain and Ireland, where the church had been deeply involved in government and power. It seems to me, and I think part of this is a rejection of all of that in the past as well.
Right.
But how did you feel when that stuff came out? Were you surprised?
You know, at first, it was hard to believe because I had never had that
me neither
experience. Okay,
I was an altar boy. I was an altar boy. Yeah. I was like, what am I? Chopped liver? No one made a pass at me.
Right, but and then at first, I kind of I don't want to say resisted it. And then the stuff in New Orleans is so bad, right? Jason Berry, who's a very good friend of mine, who's probably written enough about this than anybody.
Yeah.
And the deeper you get into it, the worse it is. And then I had this, maybe it was one of my sisters or somebody said, God, you know they're going to have to sell the Cardinals mansion in Boston. I said, good, sell the whole fucking thing. Yeah. I don't care about the Cardinals mansion.
And there was a Catholic school, boarding school for deaf kids, deaf boys. And I mean, this is a story I couldn't get over. And one of the priests chose to molest the only one who didn't know sign language because he couldn't tell his parents. There's a level of evil there that just completely, I think it's also partly to do, and I wrote about this at some risk, with the fact that fucked up gay men become priests increasingly, and some of them aren't fucked up. Some of them are wonderful priests, in fact, and some of them do and always have. But there are others who are not. And the cloak of secrecy in the closet means that you're so afraid that someone will point out that you're gay that you don't call out the person who's doing something really vile because it's a kind of omerta there and you're trapped.
And I think the hallmark of it, they would pick on less fortunate people. Oh, I think that one of the reasons they didn't pick on people like you and I is because they sort of said these fucking guys are not going to, you know.
We're not going to do it.
Yeah. I do think that there was that movie Spotlight, I thought, was really well done.
It was brilliant. It was actually one of the very few movies that gets journalism right, actually. And Marty Baron was a great editor. I don't know why he fucked up the Washington Post, but he was a brilliant editor of the Boston Globe.
Yeah, the Post is, I don't know, y'all would know that story better than I do. But.
Now tell me, Trump has been the big subject of the last decade, really, I think at this point, coming on to the last decade. And he remains to be explained, really. And I it's been hard as we're in along to understand what he was, what threats he really was, what was bluff, what was bullshit, and what was dangerous. Did your views change about him before he got elected and after he was finished his term? Hi there. This is not the end of this podcast. In fact, we're only just getting going. If you're a paid subscriber and are hearing this, it means you haven't yet signed up for the full new package to get our podcast in full. No extra charge. Just go to andrewsullivan.substack.com/listen, LISTEN, and make sure your podcast is up to date with the Dishcast. You'll be able to add it to your Dishcast feed and never have this hear this message again and go back to exactly what you've been doing for the last 2 years. And I'd like to thank you, too, for contributing for so long. If you're hearing this message and you haven't yet subscribed and want to listen to the rest of the podcast, then just subscribe. It's very easy. andrewsullivan.substack.com is $50 a year. Great value for money. And you also get with that the entire weekly dish every Friday. Not just my weekly column, but also all the comments and dissents on that column. You also have a full discussion of the previous week's Dishcast. So all those questions you had in your mind can be answered, or you can hear and read readers debating what we talked about, sometimes calling me to account. andrewsullivan.substack.com. Subscribe and get the whole thing. Join the debate. Join the fun. Subscribe.